So we entered the Olympic Park, congratulations. And now we are getting close to Big Ice Dome Большой, which is one of two biggest sport venues in the Olympic Park. It can host at the moment 12,000 people, as well as Iceberg Arena.
I'm Lucy Ash, and for the first half of this special program on the BBC World Service, I'm in Sochi, the Black Sea resort which will host the Winter Olympics in February. I was in Moscow for the BBC during the collapse of the USSR and its chaotic aftermath in the 1990s, and since then I've been a frequent visitor. Over the next hour, I'll be looking at the Russian president's record at home and abroad in the Putin Project. Vladimir Putin sees these games as the crowning glory of his 14 years in power and a celebration of Russia's re-emergence on the world stage. So no lack of superlatives on the official press tour.
Seating 40,000 spectators, Fisht Olympic Stadium soars 69 metres above the Earth's surface, exceeding the height of London's Big Ben.
The total area of this media center is 7 times bigger than Red Square in Moscow.
It is one of the best speed skating ovals in the world.
The athletes will have very comfortable accommodation, very, very spacious rooms. 3 times more than the standards of the International Olympic Committee, which will enable them to deliver the best results.
We did have the test event here, and media and, of course, the Ice Hockey International Federation, they told that it was the best in history. Everything was perfect.
President Putin himself did a sales job back in 2007 when Russia bid for the Games in Guatemala City, one of those very rare occasions when he showed off his English. There's nothing wrong, he said, with hosting the Winter Olympics in a subtropical summer holiday resort.
Sochi is a unique place. On the seashore, you can enjoy a fine spring day. But up in the mountains, it's winter. I went skiing there 6 or 7 weeks ago, and I know real snow's guaranteed.
An American magazine recently voted Vladimir Putin the world's most powerful man and noted that in the chess match over Syria, the ex-KGB officer seems to have the upper hand. In the past year, the Kremlin has been increasingly setting the agenda on global issues and throwing its weight around in the post-Soviet backyard. Now it wants these games to rebrand Russia's image and banish clichés about a corrupt, feudal state dependent on selling its oil and gas. Dmitry Kozak, the deputy prime minister in charge of the Olympics, assures me they will dazzle the world and showcase Russia's modern face.
We will show what we are capable of, our achievements and our potential. All this is crucial, not just for our image, but for our economic development. If we show that we are open to the world, that we have the resources and the people to stage such an event, then, above all, we'll have more opportunities to attract investment.
Inside the silver Balshoi Ice Dome, shaped like a gigantic blob of frozen water, somebody asked the young woman showing us around what these Olympics mean for the country.
Oh my God, it's very important. We're really waiting for these Olympic Games. For us, it's our national idea. It's a very good opportunity for us to show Russia, Russia's soul.
Russian soul?
Yes.
And how are you going to show that?
By our hospitality, I think. By our mood, by our activities, and of course by the level of the competition that we're really waiting for to present.
This is a brand new building. Everything is sparkling. Marble floors, big glass doors. This is the speed skating arena. And there's actually somebody training here. A girl in bright red lycra is zipping around the vast oval rink, arms swaying with rhythmical precision. A slightly breathless 23-year-old, Yevgenia Dmitrieva, tells us she's hoping to skate in the national team this February. But then she tells my producer, Anastasia, she's disappointed the arena will be dismantled straight after the Games.
She said that it's such a pity, but what kind of saddens her the most is that there are just 4 speed skating arenas in Russia.
Including this one
in Sochi, so there will be 3 left, not enough.
It does sound wasteful, but at $51 billion, this is the most expensive Olympic event in history, costing 25 times more than the last Winter Games in Vancouver, Canada, and $10 billion more than the Beijing Summer Games of 2008, until now the most lavish Olympics on record.
High-speed ski lifts and 2 transport hubs make it easy to move between the sports venues, the Olympic Village, hotels and the media centre.
A road built by Russian railways is one example of the ballooning costs. The government says the link between the coast and the mountain sports cluster was technically challenging and involved lots of tunnels. But on my way up to the ski resort, I still wonder about the price tag. $8.6 billion for 48 kilometres.
To illustrate the eye-wateringly high cost of this stretch of tarmac, a Russian magazine has calculated the amount of caviar, foie gras, Hennessy cognac that could be bought with the same amount of money, and how thick this Olympic road would be if it was built from these purchased goods. So to give you an example, black caviar would be 1.1 centimetres, foie gras 1.9 centimetres, Louis Vuitton handbags all kind of torn up into pieces and stretched out on the road would be 9 centimetres in thickness.
This cafe up in the revamped ski area of Rozakhuta is very plush, with designer sofas and low lighting. In fact, this whole place, with its pine-clad buildings and pastel-coloured hotels, looks just like the alpine resort of Courchevel, transplanted to the Caucasus. At the bar, we meet 2 members of the American bobsleigh team, here for some early training.
It's been fun. The track is smooth. The ice has been nice. The weather's been great. Not normal for a bobsledder, because we're used to like freezing temperatures, and it's been like 50 degrees Fahrenheit, which has been really nice.
I'm not gonna lie, when I came over here, I was a little nervous at first, because you hear all these stories, like, the Russians are mean, like, be careful, like, but everybody here is really nice and very outgoing and willing to help you out a lot.
What that lift выходит туда.
Outdoors, a tall man in a grey sweater shows me a map of the ski runs. Vladimir Sarokin, a pilot turned ski fanatic, has taken Putin skiing by helicopter. He was also the first to bring ski lifts here in the 1990s. With his business, you'd think he'd welcome the games, but he admits he's worried.
The Olympics is a huge event, masses of people. So much needed to be done to protect the environment here. A lot of work. Here we have a pristine river, unspoiled mountains. To our left, there is National Park, a protected area filled with unique plants and animals. We have got bears up there, even bison.
Inside, over a coffee, Sarokin shares more misgivings with me about corruption.
You probably know that in Russia it's the most terrible scourge. Everything starts with and revolves around that. You can start off with a really good construction project, but sooner or later an official gets involved, and he looks at you as his meal ticket.
Although the Russian taxpayer is footing much of the cost, Putin has also leaned on the oligarchs to bankroll his Olympic dream. Metals magnate Vladimir Putanin, for example, has paid for chalets and hotels, new lifts and hundreds of snow cannons to turn Sochi into a world-class resort. Yet, post-Olympics, few expect to recoup their investment by attracting Russian skiers. Judging from the price of our coffees, this resort makes the French Alps look cheap. Sarokin explains that lucrative contracts are often farmed out to cheaper subcontractors and the difference pocketed by the company. At every link in the chain from top to bottom, money is creamed off. As a result, far less is actually spent on the roads, buildings and other infrastructure than the publicly announced budget.
Как построить за маленькую сумму? то, что у них осталось, как построить.
If you only have a little bit of money left at the end, how do you think you're going to build something? It means inferior materials. It means cheaper labor. Or you don't pay people at all to make sure you have a profit. That is what you get from the kickback process.
My wife, they've told her that we should keep silent and go away. And that if you don't do this, you'll be washed with blood, you'll be drowned in blood.
In your own blood?
Yeah.
Valery Marozov, a construction company boss, and his wife Irina fled Russia in December 2011. They arrived in the UK with a suitcase filled with what they claimed were incriminating documents implicating a senior Kremlin official. The British authorities found Marozov's story compelling enough to swiftly offer him asylum. 2 years earlier, he'd won a contract to rebuild a spa complex in Sochi. But then he was summoned by Vladimir Leshchevsky from the Department of Presidential Affairs Construction Department.
I came to his office and he told me to write a letter that I've made a mistake in calculation and my price is 50% higher. And that's why I can't fulfill the obligations and I'm accepting that I've lost the tender.
And then what did you say to him?
I said that I refused. I said, no, I... We had a very tough discussion. And then he said, okay, if you want to construct, you construct. But you have to fulfill the rule, what we have here. The share should be brought to me. And he has written on the piece of paper 12% and given to me this paper.
Marozov didn't want to pay $6.5 million of what he calls corruption tax. And so he went to the police. As his wife Irina makes tea at their home near London, Marozov shows me documents from the Investigative Committee, Russia's equivalent of the FBI. It details an official sting operation to catch Leshchevsky red-handed as the cash, packed in a plastic bag, was handed over in a Moscow restaurant. But then, inexplicably, the case was dropped. The tax police began investigating Marozov's business. The death threats began, and he decided it was high time for him to leave the country.
My name is Timur Zeynalov. I'm the venue manager of the Coastal Olympic Village. Now we're standing in one of the yards inside the residential zone of the Olympic Village where athletes will reside.
And, the flats in this complex with sea views and a swimming pool in the courtyard will later be sold as holiday homes by a private company. Few Sochi residents could afford to move in, even though local activists say that more than 2,000 local families have lost their homes thanks to the Games.
Angela, tell me, like, we're standing among all this rubble, all these stones and bits of concrete and bits of rusty pipes and cables, but there's still some wallpaper that I can see here. What was in this bit of the house?
Angela Zielberg, a teacher-turned businesswoman, designed and built her own house on a hill overlooking Sochi. But 3 months ago, when she was out of town, she got some bad news.
People who lived here were calling me to tell that strangers came around the house, climbed up to the roof with the saws, started to kind of take bits and pieces of the roof and throw it down. At that time, there were around 12 people living inside the house, including 5 kids. The children were sitting in the hallway crying. We filmed it all. I have the video that proves that was happening this way. I wondered how come that no one from the city hall asks the question where all these people from this house are going to spend this night. The next day I filed the complaint and the bailiffs came around and they wouldn't even let me take my furniture out unless I bought it from them. They said everything that is here is ours. Now if you want to take it, you have to buy it from us.
The authorities claim that the house violated planning regulations, something Angela denies. Now, to add insult to injury, they say she must cover the demolition costs, 3 million rubles or $100,000, or they'll confiscate her land.
I think that this whole situation occurred because our house, the place where we're standing right now, the great location, it's a fantastic view from here, it's up the hill. Second of all, it's half a kilometer away from Putin's residence, the official residence of the President of the Russian Federation. And the best beach in Sochi with the beautiful sand. So I think that this whole nightmare that we were put through has the goal of pushing us away from this land because someone wants to grab it.
Angela's is not an isolated case. The internet is full of videos like this one in which people complain bitterly about their houses being torn down. Here, a group of residents from Gorlieneva Street have barricaded the road with car tyres, and they're shouting the name of Sochi's mayor, Anatoly Pakhomov, in desperation as riot police and bailiffs usher in the bulldozers. This doesn't look very good, does it? I asked Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Kozak.
Well, I fully admit that abuses sometimes occur, but in general we control the activities of such people. I often go to Sochi, the president keeps a close eye on things here, as does the prime minister. It's true that in the past some people have been in too much of a hurry to build without going through the correct procedures. They've knocked down houses, got rid of backyards and gardens. We looked into such cases and punished the officials involved. This sort of thing is inevitable, you know. But that doesn't mean it's widespread. In 7 years, I have only had to deal with 10 complaints like this in a city of 400,000 people.
Kozak insists that corruption in Sochi is limited to petty stuff, such as the theft of tools from building sites. He doesn't mention that criminal cases involving officials have increased significantly in the run-up to the Games. Last year, there were 6 cases of forgery, fraud and abuse of authority involving 9 members of the Sochi city administration. In the first half of this year, the prosecutor of the Krasnodar region reported 11 criminal cases involving millions of dollars stolen by executives building Sochi Olympic facilities. And isn't this just the tip of the iceberg? I asked Dmitry Kozak.
Look, we are all civilized people. We all believe in the presumption of innocence. And how can we discuss such things without a court decision and actual convictions for embezzlement or fraud? Back in 2007, as soon as we got the right to hold the Olympics, we organized special units to monitor the use of budget funds. And our law enforcement agencies see rooting out theft and other abuses as a matter of professional honor. They have to justify their salaries after all. The answer is that as of today, there is no proof of massive corruption involving millions or billions of dollars. No proof at all.
But many, like the exiled construction boss Valery Marozov, say that the most serious cases will be postponed until after the closing ceremony or simply swept under the carpet.
The thing is that they've taken a very comfortable position for themselves. Their position is like this. You should prove first in court that this is corruption, the money has been taken, and then only you can speak. But the problem is that this system comprises all the branches of the state power, including the courts. So they got the courts under control. So that means it is not possible to win against them. That's why the situation is like this. The business is robbed, hates the system, keeps silent.
Workers are cutting tiles to go around the swimming pool in the Olympic Village. Most of the venues look ready, but I discover that many of the Uzbeks, Tajiks and other workers from former Soviet republics who were asked to help build them are no longer welcome in Sochi. And they're being chased out by local Cossacks, descended from the border guards and soldiers of Tsarist Russia. Regional governor Alexander Tkachev, who has Cossack blood himself, put 1,000 of his fellow Cossacks on the government's payroll with the task of patrolling the region's cities. This September, he addressed men in traditional Cossack uniforms lined up in the city centre, effectively a deportation militia.
Сегодня в Сочи работает огромная армия приезжих.
There's a huge army of migrants in Sochi, he says. And now their contracts have finished, they're playing hide and seek with us. But we won't allow that. We'll repatriate the lot of them as soon as possible. Early one morning, I watch how they work.
The Cossacks have now set off with the police and the migration service into lots of different smaller white vans. And they're going to conduct house-to-house searches. They sometimes also slow down when they approach a bus stop, look out to see if they can see any people that they think might be illegal immigrants.
Right, looks like we've got somewhere. So I'm going to get out and see what they're doing.
Outside a supermarket, they stop to question two young men in leather jackets. But it turns out the men are Chechens, citizens of the Russian Federation, so they can't be deported. I ask the policeman next to me how he feels about the Cossacks. He tells me they have their own culture and command structure, but they're disciplined. A bit like the Red Armband volunteers who helped keep order in Soviet times. Then I approach one of the men wearing a papakha, a traditional Cossack hat. Are you one of the leaders, I ask him.
Dobre utro. Yeah, Lucy. It's BBC.
Oh.
Один из лидеров казаков.
Нет. Мы интервью не даем. Служим России казачеству. Служим России и казачеству.
No interviews. All he'll say is we serve Russia and the Cossacks. And then they're off hunting foreigners. But many who are in Russia legally have also been targeted. In a garage crammed with bunk beds, one young Uzbek plasterer, who doesn't want to give his name, tells me about coming home from work with friends a few days ago.
We were waiting to cross the road at a red light when we were stopped by the police.
Two of his workmates were pushed into the police car and later deported, even though he says that all their papers were in order. He escaped because he had a photocopy of his passport in his pocket. Now he's afraid to go out, even to the shops alone.
I want to go back home now. I don't feel free walking around the streets here anymore.
With anti-immigrant riots in Moscow and elsewhere, 2013 has seen an outpouring of race hatred. Under Putin, Slav nationalism has become mainstream. But growing anger about immigration from former Soviet states poses a dilemma for the president. Can he afford to alienate the countries he wants inside his new Eurasian customs union? That's something I'll be looking at in part two of the Putin Project, coming up after the news.
Documentaries on the BBC World Service.
The 2014 Winter Olympic Games in Sochi are a chance for Vladimir Putin to showcase a resurgent Russia.
It's a very good opportunity for us to show Russia, Russia's soul, to all the world.
I'm Lucy Ash, and behind the gloss, I'll be looking at what the games mean for the ordinary citizen, and I'll be tracking Putin's maneuvers on the world stage.
Many people don't trust that an airstrike would have solved anything in Syria. We had people singing praise, Putin won, America cannot just launch wars anymore, Russia is back.
After 14 years at the top, just how powerful is the KGB officer turned president?
Definitely Putin is riding the tide, not because Russia is strong, but because the West is weak.
The Putin Project. Catch up online at bbcworldservice.com. I'm Lucy Ash, and in part two of the Putin Project, I'll be tracking the Russian president's recent manoeuvres in the so-called Near Abroad. Is he really trying to recreate the old Soviet Union? And what lies behind Russia's agenda in the Middle East? Is it a bid to shape global events through great power diplomacy, a mission to save persecuted Christians, or an attempt to keep the lid on a homegrown Islamic insurgency? All that in a couple of minutes.
BBC News with Mike Cooper.
China has accused Japan of using concerns about national security and regional peace as a pretext for military expansion. Earlier this week, Japan announced that it would spend more than $230 billion over the next 5 years on advanced equipment, including stealth aircraft. The head of the army in Thailand has warned of possible civil war if elections, scheduled for early February, go ahead in the current polarized political climate. The Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra called the elections after weeks of protests. A Taiwanese court has suspended the trial of the former president Chun Shui-bian because he's suffering from depression and is said to be a suicide risk. The former president is already serving a 20-year prison term after being found guilty of corruption. Memorial services are due to be held in Britain and the US to mark the 25th anniversary of the Lockerbie bombing. 270 people were killed when an American airliner was blown up over the Scottish town in 1988. A Libyan man, Abdel Basset Almagrahi, was the only person convicted for carrying out the attack. In Turkey, several high-profile suspects have been formally placed under investigation as part of a sweeping corruption inquiry. Reports say those detained for corruption and fraud include the sons of two ministers and the chief executive of the state-owned Halkbank. The former Russian oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was pardoned and released from prison in Russia on Friday, has been reunited with his eldest son in Berlin. Mikhail Khodorkovsky spent 10 years in prison after being convicted of fraud and tax evasion, charges which he's always denied. A Chinese billionaire is feared to have died in a helicopter crash while flying over the French vineyard he had just bought. Three other people were on the helicopter with the Hong Kong-based entrepreneur Lam Kok, including his 12-year-old son and the man who sold him the vineyard, James Gregoire. BBC News.
Welcome back to The Putin Project with me, Lucy Ash, here on the BBC World Service. In this special programme, I'm looking at the Russian president's endeavour to re-establish Russia as a great power, reclaim the country's traditional spheres of influence, and promote its role as a protector of Christian values, both at home and abroad. In recent weeks, hundreds of thousands of demonstrators have braved freezing temperatures in what looks like a rerun of Ukraine's 2004 Orange Revolution. The protests were sparked by the Ukrainian government's decision not to sign a partnership deal with the European Union, despite years of negotiations aimed at integrating Russia's western neighbour with the 28-nation bloc. On the streets and on Kiev's main square, renamed Euromaidan, the word was that President Viktor Yanukovych had caved in to pressure from Vladimir Putin, that he'd been seduced by promises of credit and cheap Russian gas.
Ukraine is a test of Putin's and the Kremlin's attractiveness, of its power, of its might, of its seduction.
Lilia Shevtsova of the Carnegie Foundation sees Putin's own creation, the Eurasian Customs Union, a free trade zone across much of the former Soviet Union, as an attempt to turn the clock back. For the man who once described the collapse of the USSR as the 20th century's greatest geopolitical catastrophe, the stakes couldn't be higher.
Subordinated Ukraine means that Russia still is an empire. And for many people within the Russian political establishment, to lose Ukraine means to lose a limb, you know, because Eurasian alliance that Putin would like to build without Ukraine would be something, you know, not ambitious and pretty pathetic. That's why the Kremlin would continue to suppress, to cajole, to scare Ukrainians in order to prevent Ukrainians going in the opposite direction.
It's not just Ukraine which has felt the heat from Moscow. These are anti-Putin protests in a much smaller country, one which has received little international attention. But it's one where you can see the Putin project for the near abroad most clearly. This is Armenia. This small country in the South Caucasus spent years preparing for an association agreement with the EU. But then Armenia did a Ukrainian-style U-turn after intense pressure from the big northern brother.
Right now, Armenia is in difficulties
but we have a very good relationship with Russia, and I think they really help us. That means a lot for us.
Now, relations with Russia is good to us than relations with Europe.
Russia is better for Armenia than Europe.
Oh, I can't say that it's better, but Russia is our partner, military partner, and it suits us to relate with Russia.
Viktor Yengabaryan, an IT consultant and president of Armenia's European movement, isn't sure about that.
We Armenians are European, so there is no discussion about this topic anymore. There is a huge consensus. Society also sees the European Union as a chance to modernize the economy in Armenia, but also it is a way to become more democratic.
But why do you think it is that your president changed his mind after the meeting with Vladimir Putin on the 3rd of September? Why? What happened?
I think Kremlin politicians became very jealous about the Eastern Partnership. The pressure was not about Armenia to join the customs union. It was more about to stop the European integration of Armenia.
Unlike Ukraine, Armenia is in that tricky region where Europe meets Asia, and its decisions seem largely governed by where it sits on the map. Early on, I get the sense of a country which sees itself as a Christian outpost in a hostile neighborhood.
I'm coming up a metal ladder from a prison. It's one of the deepest prisons I've ever been in. It'd be very difficult to get out of here. Well, that's a very sheer drop there.
At the monastery of Hor Virap, which means deep hole, I've just visited the dungeon where a Christian bishop was locked up in the 4th century. When King Tardat fell ill and the bishop managed to cure him, the pagan monarch was so grateful he instantly converted, and Armenia became the first country in the world to adopt Christianity as a state religion, and the bishop became a saint. My guide, Armenian journalist David Muradyan, points out a snowy peak bathed in peach-coloured light.
You can see Ararat, but you can also see much closer a watchtower, because we're very close to the Turkish border, aren't we?
Yeah, it's very close. You can just scream out and everybody can listen to it.
You can also, I mean, I can see over there the spire of a mosque, which is in Turkey.
Yeah, it is in Turkey.
So you can hear the call to prayer from here.
Yeah, there is a huge NATO military base on Mount Ararat.
Mount Ararat may be Armenia's national symbol, but it too is in Turkey. The border closed more than a decade ago. Relations between tiny Armenia and its huge prosperous neighbour have been strained ever since 1915, when, according to the Armenians, 1.5 million people were killed by the Ottoman Turks. Back in Yerevan, Prime Minister Tigran Sarkisian blames geography for the U-turn and the decision to join Russia's customs union.
To understand our relationships, it's enough to look at the map.
If you want to understand our relationship, just look at the map. We're hemmed in by neighbors. Two of them, Turkey and Azerbaijan, are hostile, and that's putting it mildly. We have to build bridges with countries that link us to the outside world. First and foremost, our natural ally, Russia, because we share certain traditions, age-old friendship, and Christian values. We would like to develop our ties with Europe and discover new opportunities there. At the same time, we must consider our vital interests. We have no alternative.
Here's a strange thing. Armenia has no common border with Russia, but Russian troops guard its frontiers with Turkey and Azerbaijan. That's the carrot. But the Kremlin also has a stick, selling tanks and rocket launchers to Armenia's mortal enemy, neighbouring Azerbaijan. Prime Minister Sarkisian brushes aside my question about a link between arms sales and the decision to join Putin's customs union. But economist and former MP Tatul Manasseryan is more explicit about Armenia's choices when it comes to national security.
In my personal meetings with high-rank officials of European Union, the officials are
quite open and sincere to say that we cannot do the same as Russia.
But how does Moscow guarantee Armenia's security by selling weapons to Azerbaijan, which is basically your enemy?
Frankly, it's not something that we like, but from Russia's point of view, they describe this deal as a pure business transaction. And for the moment, there is no alternative to the Russian soldiers and troops that are on the border protecting the country.
There's not much choice when it comes to exports either. Everyone here knows how Russia blocked imports of Ukrainian chocolate and Moldovan wine in the run-up to the EU summit last month.
10-year-old exclusive branded wine with 50%.
At the factory producing one of Armenia's most celebrated products, such threats are hard to swallow.
Shushan, ever since we came in here, I'm feeling sort of slightly intoxicated. You can really smell the cognac, can't you? It's coming out from the barrels.
Yes. We lose brandy spirit, about 20 liters from each barrel every year through evaporation, but this is the only way to attain high quality. So it is called very poetically angel's share.
It's the angel's share, because it evaporates and goes up to heaven.
Yes.
But as for the cognac which stays on Earth, 87% of it goes to traditional markets, Russia and the former Soviet republics. In fact, Armenia remains dependent on Russia for almost everything, from uranium imports to railway lines and, crucially, jobs. Around 1 million Armenians have made the flight to find work in Russia, more than a third of the entire population. Remittances make up 30% of Armenia's GDP. No wonder the government here is still haunted by the memory of plane loads of Georgian migrant workers who were sent home after the conflict between Russia and Georgia back in 2008. And TV pictures of anti-foreigner riots in Moscow and other Russian cities have rattled Prime Minister Sarkisian.
We are keeping an eye on the political process in Russia because many of our fellow citizens live and work there. Certainly, this rise in reactionary nationalism alarms us, and our Russian colleagues share this concern. We need to follow this closely and stay in touch to avoid any unpleasant developments.
So Armenia is safely back in the fold. But Putin is seeking influence well beyond the ex-Soviet space. He wants to restore Russia's place at the top table and shape global events through great power diplomacy. So next stop, the Middle East.
We've just stopped by a mosque at the side of the road in Irbid, which is just a bit north of the capital, Amman. And we're sort of at the top of a hill looking down into a view of lots of houses and tower blocks. And it's quite hazy in the distance, but there are some hills there.
And behind these hills is Syria, and it's what, about 15 kilometres up, far from here. Well, in the summertime, you can see the top of the Jabal al-Sheikh, al-Sheikh Mount in Damascus. Damascus can be seen from here.
There are so many Syrian refugees in the Jordanian city of Irbid that schools are working double shifts to accommodate hundreds of extra pupils.
Damascus.
You're from Damascus, from the capital, yeah? Where are you from?
Dera.
You're from Dera.
I'm 14. His name is Abdullah Mafakh Salamat.
His name is Abdullah and he's 14 years old.
You're 14. And when you were in Syria, did you have to miss any school because of the fighting?
He didn't go to school for 2 months.
We have to engage our professionals together with the Chemical Weapons Prohibition Organization, as we agreed with.
When Putin's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov suggested Russia and the US should jointly monitor Syria's chemical weapons in September, many were caught off guard, including the Jordanian analyst Lamiz Andoni.
Many people don't trust that an airstrike would have solved anything in Syria. Really, for a few weeks, we had people like singing praise of Russia. Putin won, Russia is back, America cannot just launch wars anymore. Russia is here. Russia emerged as the winner.
It was a deft piece of diplomacy. Lavrov got credit for averting an American airstrike and for reasserting Russia's role, all while his country continued to supply weapons to President Assad and provide diplomatic cover at the UN for the Syrian regime. So what's Russia's game plan, I ask Alexander Kalugin. The ambassador to Jordan has a reputation as a power broker in the region, pulling strings behind the scenes.
Our goal is not to protect Bashar Assad. We are here to establish the supremacy of international law and to ensure a peaceful solution to the Syrian crisis. This is our main motive. We are sometimes accused of caring too much for Assad. We don't think about Assad. It's up to the Syrian people to decide whether he is legitimate or not. This can't be resolved by external players.
Is there a sense that the West has lost its moral authority after what have been sort of widely seen as failures in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, of course, Iraq is a sad page in the history of the West. I will not dwell on that, but having spent 20 years of my life there, I'll say one thing. Soon after the invasion, we had talks with the Americans, and they were in a euphoric mood. President Bush had announced on May the 2nd that the war is over and so forth. And they told us about the great plans they had for Iraq. I asked these people from the State Department, the Pentagon and other agencies if they had specialists who knew Iraq well. They said, oh yeah, we do. But what really counts are democratic values. They are universal. We just need to promote democracy in Iraq and everything will be fine. Unfortunately, that's not how things turned out.
So, the Putin project is all about preserving the principle of national sovereignty. Ukrainians and Armenians might have something to say about that. But Lamiz Andoni, the Jordanian political commentator, says the West is in no position to criticise.
The US has a very dismal record in the region, even worse. And people who used to support the revolution in Syria are now afraid of a heavy American involvement because they see Iraq. The first argument that people give you is that we don't want to see another Iran in Syria. That has helped Russian image in the region. However, that doesn't change the fact that Russia is about interests. It's not about human rights. It's about what's good for Russia. It shouldn't support Assad and give a blind eye to atrocities that are committed by the regime.
Russia is heavily involved in the killings of the Syrian people. As a politician, I can understand the interests between the countries, but with politics, there are no morals. And Russia is playing a very dirty role.
Hassan al-Kakuni, an opposition leader from the Syrian town of Dera, was once something of a Slavophile. Like many of his generation, he got his higher education in the former Soviet Union. But since then, he's been tortured in a Syrian police cell and narrowly avoided a sniper's bullet. Now a refugee in Jordan, he's sick of these superpower playoffs at the Syrians' expense.
Okay, Russia is trying to keep its location, its power in the Middle East, and we know the games between Russia and the United States. But 30 months of killing of the Syrian people with these Russian weapons.
Early in the morning in the Jordanian capital, Amman, Syrian refugees are queuing for their food coupons. Outside in the yard, with the help of Wuj, my translator, I ask some of the refugees about Russia's role in their homeland.
Russia was responsible for killing half of the young men in Syria, including my husband. I guess Russia is a partner of the killing in Syria, and Russian people should be responsible for that.
Why do you say that Russia is responsible?
We were killed by the Russian armory. My husband was killed by a Russian weapon.
A Russian weapon? Can I ask you?
And because of the Russian veto, they refused to solve the problem.
Because of the Russian veto in the United Nations. But which weapon was your husband killed by, do you know?
She said by rockets, but they're like Russian writings on it.
There was Russian Cyrillic script on the rocket.
On the rocket.
The one that killed your husband?
Said yes.
So is there a lot of anger now in Syria against Russia? Because it used to be an ally, an ally for more than 40 years of the Syrian government.
Not anymore. Russia is our enemy, side by side with the president.
But such hostility doesn't seem to trouble Russian ambassador Alexander Kalugin, who now answers in English.
We can understand the feelings of these miserable people, but they are very far from politics, and I don't think that really they know who is exactly fueling this crisis. There is a lot of weapons coming to this country, and I think people don't care by which weapons they are killed or their children killed. They care only about one thing, to have stability and peace and be far from these events. That's why these emotional feelings are understandable, but Russia is not fueling this crisis by deliveries. It's not true.
But, if Russia wants to stop the killing, which I assume it does, wouldn't it be better to stop the weapons coming in?
We are fulfilling our contracts, but best way to stop fighting is to launch political process, which we are now trying to do with our American partners, with our Western partners, with Arab countries, because so far we have a lot of weapons coming from Gulf countries, from Gulf organizations. That's why I think we must now launch, first of all, political process. It's the only way.
Lilia Shevtsova of the Carnegie Center says Putin has another important card up his sleeve, one marked with a cross.
Now he endorsed the new updated foreign policy doctrine, which is based on one premise: the West is weak. They will never rise again. So Russia is coming, and Russia has to fill the vacuum left by the United States and the West. And even more, the key element of Putin's doctrine is support and defend the traditional Christian values all around the world, not only in Russia. This is a totally new element in Russia after 20 years, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now we have a kind of quasi-Iranian model where the power, the civil power and the church are going together, sending the common message. Russia is the defender of traditional Christian values.
Putin has called upon such values to sanctify the jailing of Pussy Riot and the homophobic legislation that's provoked calls to boycott his cherished Sochi Olympics. At the same time, Russia is increasingly seeing itself as protector of Christians across the Middle East. And according to the Foreign Ministry, some 50,000 Christians from Syria are applying now for Russian citizenship. Envoys of the Orthodox Church erected a monumental statue of Christ on top of the Cherubim Mountain in Syria in October to symbolise hope and peace. Another group, the Imperial Orthodox Society of Palestine, founded by Tsar Alexander III to represent Orthodox pilgrims in the Holy Land, now includes many senior Kremlin officials. Asked about Western initiatives in Syria, its spokesman, Igor Petrakov, sounded mournful.
Most unfortunately, the West's idea of help involves financing the units that do the fighting. And I think this is a very dangerous thing to do, because when the war in Syria stops, where all those armed people will go? In which direction will the rifles point? Historically, Russia is deeply connected with Syria. Last year, when the situation there became really tragic, we decided to provide humanitarian help, medicines, baby milk, food, etc. And our decision was backed by the Russian Patriarch Kirill. Yes, the initial desire was to support our Christian brothers and sisters, but today our help goes to everyone who needs it.
This isn't just religious solidarity. The Kremlin sees protecting Christians as part of a mission to protect Russia itself. In a video posted on the internet in June, Doku Umarov tells his followers to use maximum force to disrupt the Olympics. The Chechen warlord is fighting to impose Islamic rule in Russia's North Caucasus, the mountainous region that borders Sochi. Dressed in green army fatigues and speaking from the forest, he called for attacks on what he calls satanic games on the bones of our Muslim ancestors. This is not an idle threat. Umarov has claimed responsibility for the attacks on the Moscow metro and main airport. Ambassador Alexander Kalugin.
We are worried. We don't hide it. I mean, that's why we do our best to come to any arrangement, agreement concerning the Syrian crisis. Certainly, it's very near to our country. We have also problems in the Northern Caucasus. That's why all these radicals, they can easily come to our regions in the south, and we can face quite unstable situation in some parts of our country. That's why we are worried. I mean, we do not hide it.
How many Russian nationals are fighting in Syria at the moment?
You never can say it exactly. I don't think it's thousands, maybe some hundreds. But these people must be counted not in numbers, but their high professionalism in fighting, because they know nothing in their lives but only to fight. That's why they are very dangerous.
What went through your mind when you heard about the woman who blew herself up on a bus a few weeks ago in Volgograd, killing five other people?
Certainly it's very sad that we still must face this problem when wives of these radical people or terrorists, they also join suicide operations against innocent people like it happened in Volgograd. But my big hope that it's just an isolated incident. They have weapons, they have money, it comes from external sources. So we must work to close all these channels of deliveries to these people.
Do you feel under additional pressure to close these channels with the Olympics coming up?
I don't know details, but I think our FSB counterintelligence service is quite professional, and they will do their best in order to provide a positive and quiet atmosphere of Olympic Games.
Возле моря располагается Олимпийский парк. A number of world leaders have already said they're not coming to Sochi. Perhaps that's why Putin has just announced an amnesty, which includes the Greenpeace 30, Pussy Riot, and the country's most famous prisoner, once Russia's richest man, Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Was this an act of Christian mercy, or a chance to show who's boss? After the chaotic 90s, Putin came to power promising stability. That's his leitmotif, along with order, respect for national sovereignty, and morality built on a Christian heritage. His critics say this value system promotes the flip side, corruption, Russian chauvinism, and contempt for the rule of law. Petro-rubles pay for lavish spending in Sochi, and they provide the carrot offered to Russia's poorer near abroad. The question is, will the Putin project survive when the oil wells run dry? The Putin Project was produced by Anastasia Uspianskaya of the BBC Russian Service. Documentaries.